All right. Hello, everyone. I'm Stephen Roberts, and I'm the producer of Giving Children Hope with Donna Ferris and Tanis. So I want to welcome everybody to the show. Welcome, Donna. Welcome, Tanis.
Thanks, Stephen.
Hi. Thank you, Stephen. This is Donna. Hi, Tanis. Nice to see you, too.
Hi, Donna.
Stephen, thank you again for having the Giving Children Hope show on tonight. We have a very important topic that we're going to cover. We're going to talk about our children who have run away, are currently out on the streets, run away from their court-ordered abusive homes, and we'll get to more of that in a minute. But as we've kind of started doing in the last couple shows, we're going to stick to it. I'll start the show off with a scripture. Tanis?
Yes, once again, I mean, God is so amazing. I was planning on reading from Psalm 139, which I'd invite any of the people to read, and the mothers also listening who have been segregated from their children, in terms of God knitting together our precious children in our wombs and knowing them from before they were born. But I asked for, in prayer, you know, to guide us for the show tonight. And once again, I opened up to, even though there was no marker, 2 Samuel 22, where King David is talking about. And I, the reason why I bring in scripture to make it present, so even though it was King David, let's think about all of us in this and our children. In my trouble, I called upon the Lord. The Lord saved King David from all those who hated him. He said, the Lord is my rock, my strong place, and the one who sets me free, who sets us free, where I go to be safe. In the trouble, in my trouble, I called upon the Lord. The word of the Lord has proven to be true. He is covering to all who go to him to be safe. Your help, God, makes me us strong. You give me a big place for my steps. I have not fallen. For you have dressed me with strength for this battle. You have put under me those who come against me, and for us, I'm saying us tonight. This is a battle. This is a battle for our children, the children that are in these situations, to be set free, to be protected, to be covered, to be safe. And we are very concerned that many of these children are being trafficked for sexual exploitation and profit. And human trafficking has been a growing black market industry. And when we speak the truth about this, to help as many young people as we can, it is a battle because there are many people invested in the truth not being exposed and the light not being shone in the truth. But we trust that God's going to be and is with us in this battle. So I'll pass it over to you, Donna.
Yeah, amen. Amen.
Amen.
A great scripture to start out with tonight. And I agree that this is a battle for our children's lives. This topic that we're going to discuss tonight, just to give, you know, any new listeners a little background information, the Giving Children Hope show, the fundamental basis of this show is to discuss what is happening in our family law courts all around the world, because this is a pandemic. It's a child trafficking, kidnapping ring that where anybody can go into these courts and actually pay for custody of their child. Anyone who's a criminal and wants to avoid any type of criminal punishment or arrest, you know, say it's a violent offender, wants to avoid anything for domestic violence or child abuse, they can run to our family law courts and get the custody of our children. And it typically happens from the protective, the loving parent, once the child has disclosed any type of abuse, sexual or physical abuse. That parent typically goes to our family law court to seek protection, because that's what's in place. We have to go there to get a protection from abuse order, and that's when it all starts. So the topic tonight that we're going to discuss is these children, the children that are on the run and on the streets. And it's because of this child custody kidnapping, trafficking that's happening in our family law courts. These are the children that really get, in my mind, I believe, are get really lost and forgotten about. These are the children that initially disclosed that a parent was, for example, sexually abusing them. The other parent then went to the court. He tried to get a protection for that child. These are the children that, you know, even though there was evidence of significant abuse, in almost every single case, there's a mountain of evidence, and from expert witnesses, I have yet to see a case where there isn't. And these children, they were believed. And I know that sounds weird, and I know that sounds odd to say, because if they were believed, they wouldn't have been put into the arms of their abuser. But what I'm saying is that because of this organized crime that's happening, the children that are believed are forcefully silenced by being put into the arms of their abusers. Tannis, did you want to add to this? We were talking about the child disclosures.
I just unmuted. Yes, the reason why we are making this connection with and referencing it to human trafficking, there is a great deal of awareness growing now about the magnitude of human trafficking, but there is not a connection made by most people, even those that are working as experts in this area or at exposing human trafficking, that this could actually be happening deliberately I'm just looking for this reference, through custody orders. There's a group of experts that wrote, we have to create an environment in which it's safe for victims to come forward and seek help. He said, this is from the University College at the Fraser Valley University College Fraser Valley expert testified, keeping in mind that they are, his children, youth, young adults, seriously at risk of reprisal or intimidation from their captors here in he's saying Canada, where while their families face terrorism back in their homeland. Now, these children that have disclosed sexual abuse and then are not protected are effectively held in captivity, not unlike these other situations. Successful human traffickers have become adept at using various simple but very effective methods of psychological control over their victims. They know how to break a victim's self-confidence and self-efficacy, crush their hopes, and condition them to resign themselves to a life of exploitation in which they are trapped. Now, in the connection with the custody orders, these children have expressed fear. They've expressed that they do not want to be with the individual that they have told authorities has abused them, and yet they're trapped in these custody orders until they're 18. And they're told that that's the way it is until they're 18, age of majority. And many of them become very hopeless. The incidence of depression and suicide is pronounced. So we're wanting to be part of that community of creating an environment in which it's safe for victims to come forward, because children in these situations and youth have learned that it's not safe to come forward to anybody. And those that they did go forward to didn't help and protect them. And in many cases, their mothers were not, in most of these cases, it's their mothers that were not able to protect them either.
Right. I think you said that perfectly. I just want to hit on a couple of things. You know, exactly where you said that they're held captive until they're 18. That's exactly true. And then even some children 18 on, because imagine the trauma and abuse and battering that's happening to this child, these children. You know, first in the custody kidnapping, in these protocols, the first thing that they do is and the judges is sign off on these court orders, ordering these children into the sole custody of their identified abuser. And we're talking about identified through various expert witnesses, forensic technology. You know, this is what we're talking about. And a judge will sign that court order anyway, and send that child to go live solely with that abuser. And then what happens from that further on is the protective parent that initially ran to the court because that parent believed their child is erased out of their child's life. And it can happen slowly. They can be erased by having supervised visits held over their head, where it's basically a game they play, and as long as you obey and follow the rules and don't step out of line, your child doesn't either. You can continue to see your child, or it might get little to little, or you might get none at all and just be chased away because they don't want anybody to find out what they just did to you, which was to steal your child from you. These children are ordered into the sole custody of their abuser, and they have to stay there. There are no rights for children. They say that their children have rights. There are no rights, especially in the United States. There's no identified right for children. They're there until 18, being battered and abused and isolated and forcefully silenced. The children that survive, because some children are killed at the hands of their abusers, like we discussed last week on the show, the alarming rates of young children, babies being killed and being seriously injured and killed at the hands of their abusers, even in Florida alone. You know, and then the children that make it to 18, they have screamed and fought and tried to survive for so long, and with no one in their mind, no one listening, no one believing them. When actually that is the problem, is everybody believed them, as they had to be silenced even more. So the ones that make it to 18, that depending on how bad they've been beaten down and battered through the years and brainwashed and manipulated, and remember, the protected parent, the loving parent, had they been isolated from and erased from for years. So just imagine this child being so isolated and feeling so alone that even at 18, even an adult, and having so many mental health issues stemming from what they've endured to that point, there's still nothing saying they won't continue to be held captive. And especially if their abuser still is in their life and still has that control over them, that level of fear for them remains. And so it's still not even likely that they'll ever have a real true life of their own. Now, the children that we're focusing on tonight are the ones that run from this court-ordered abusive home. We're talking about the children where it just takes so much courage and so much bravery to take that step and run, knowing that not one person in their mind, okay, and this is a child's mind, thinking in their mind that not one person listened to them, not one person believed them, not one person helped them. Even if that person said, you know, a guardian ad litem or another attorney or a therapist or someone promised them, I'll help you, but they never heard from that person again. You know, this is where they're left, that not one person is going to believe them, not one person is going to help them, and they're running for their lives and they're out on the streets. These are the children who are true heroes in my book, because imagine the courage it took to step out of the control of their abuser alone, let alone running out on our streets as a child. You know, we've got young children out on our streets. We've got, I can't even tell you the youngest child, but I know of some right now, 12, 14 years old, out on the streets alone. And imagine this weather that we've been having here in Maine itself, you know, blizzard conditions. We've had negative 20 below, negative 30 below, where schools are closed. and these children are out running on the streets. I can't, in my own opinion, Tanis, and you can tell me what you think, but I really don't see these children even going to a local youth shelter just for the fear alone of being found. Because if they're found, what happens? They get brought back to the abuser's home because there's a court order signed by a judge that tells that police officer they have to bring them back.
So That's exactly right. From the research I've done, no matter where these children go, even a helpline, anything that is connected with the government services, sends them right back to child welfare, and child welfare takes them right back to where the custody order is. And in these cases, they often their abuser has sole custody, much like marriage license used to be a reason for the abuser to be able to control the partner, their wife, for psychologically, right? Even though that individual being abused was an adult, now it's the same with children. Only they don't have the independence that an adult does. So they are more entrapped, and then they're also open to other predators that are out there. I didn't catch the beginning of it, but most of a program this week called about human trafficking, and these were the focus was the young women, actually some teens, but young adults even that were lured to come to the North America. I think in this case the U.S. from a Slavic country. And then as soon as they arrived, they were brought into a sex trafficking ring, and there was no escaping. One was a young woman in her 20s, and she had a child. It's probably based on a true story. And they were just completely trapped. Now, people have said about these kids in custody orders, well, if there's abuse or anything that's happening, like that they disclosed before, they'd be able to leave, like, you know what, at 14, at 16, like they'd be free to leave. And that is sheer, you know, ignorance on people's part in actually saying that, because it's not true. They're exactly. Not free to leave. They're trapped. They're actually trapped like hostages, and they are entrapped psychologically.
Yep, exactly. And I'll tell you honestly, and for people who don't know about me, I am a retired state of Maine rostered guardian ad litem. I've worked family law and child protective cases for years in multiple counties in the state of Maine. But I've also had my own two sons kidnapped from me within 3 months of my ex-husband nearly killing our oldest son in front of our youngest son. He went in and did the pay-to-play or kids for cash, whatever you call it, the protocol, after I was forced to go to our courts for a protection order. My sons, more than once, and I had a handful of supervised visits following the kidnapping, and it was a handful that spanned about 7 months in time, and almost every single time that I got to see my children, they were begging me to run away. They wanted to run away, but I had to make them promise me that they wouldn't. And it's exactly for this reason. And I kept telling them, if you were to run, I would be more panicked. I wouldn't be able to eat, sleep. I mean, not even now I can't, but you know what I mean? It would just, but not knowing where they are out there. You know, at least I know, yes, they're in danger, and yes, they're in their father's sole custody, and they're living in his house, under his roof, in his care 24/7. But these children are out on the street with strangers, predators. You know, my sons were 12 and 15 at the time that they were kidnapped. And I just couldn't imagine them being anywhere out in the cold, on the streets, in the dark, no money, no food, no cell phone. My sons don't even know if I'm alive right now. So they would be out there. Our children would be out there on the streets as runaways. That's what we call them, runaways, which I don't think describes them at all. They're heroes. But they're out on the streets because to them it's safer being out there in the dark, in the cold, with no food, no home, not a living soul with them. But it's safer for them than to be in their abuser's home. You know, they're not free to leave. And when a child does decide to leave, make that decision to leave, God bless that child's heart, because that's the toughest survivor I'll ever meet on this planet.
Maybe we should say a bit, Dawn, about what happens when they try to make it back to their safe, protective parent or family member, and how it's set up in the courts. That if they do try that, they're either threatened and intimidated. That they try if they try to seek out, in most of these cases, their moms will be criminalized, and even sent to prison. So they're told that these children are living with that constant intimidation, and who knows what else. Human traffickers, for example, intimidate strangers that they'll kill family members if they ever tell anybody, if they ever report what they're going through to the police, if they ever try to run away. So imagine when their abuser has the sole custody, the threat that they can, you know, the threat and intimidation that they can keep them under control with, the constant fear of anything they do. So that's part of the reason why they don't go either to try to, you know, even if they know where their mother is. Many protective parents, mothers, stay where they always lived. So the child could probably find them as a teenager especially, but doesn't. And people then think, oh, they're fine where they are. They're the reason they're not reaching out to the parent that they've been cut off from is because they're fine.
Right. That's a very good point that you bring up. You know, actually, that's what's happened in my case when I ran into my son. And again, I'm just going to say in my own case, I was forced to run. I was forced to sell everything, including my home, to fight this in court, thousands of dollars. I was forced out of my own county for safety, for my safety, for my life. And I know many other parents that I've met that have endured the same custody kidnapping, that have had to run, and even to other states for their safety. Because you're talking about criminals who get full custody of our children and a license to further abuse, and that means even us, and come after us. So we have to run and hide just to save our own lives. So a majority of our children have no idea where we are. We've been erased from their life, and they don't know how or why, because suddenly they just didn't see mom or see dad anymore. It's not just a mother or father thing. This can happen to anybody. And they're left just kind of wondering what happened. Excuse me. They're, like you said, they get threatened and intimidated. If they try to leave or want to go find a protective parent, and what happened with me is even after seeing my son and not even knowing if I was alive for almost a year and a half, I saw him in a public parking lot. All of a sudden, I mean, I could have dropped to my knees. I couldn't believe my son was right there, my youngest son. I hug him under 2 minutes of full force threats by my ex-husband, right in front of our son, too. I couldn't even believe it. And I'm hugging him, and now that's a police photo, which is actually my profile picture on Facebook, because my ex-husband then had me charged for hugging our son after both of us didn't even know we were both alive for a year and a half. So children, yes, there's the threat there, there's the intimidation. My son's learned very quickly that the intimidation of throwing the mother in jail is there. I was charged. And thank you to the public outcry, that charge was dropped, but now there's another one. But anyway, when they also came to kidnap my children, they told them, if you don't go with us, the police told them, if you don't go with us, your mother is going with us in handcuffs. So there's a lot of different fear and intimidation put in these children. So let's talk about the children where this is a similar situation and yet they've run away. You know, who are they going to trust out on the streets? This is why I said, Tanis, I don't even think you're going to find these children in our local youth shelters. You know, these children, some of them were even in domestic violence shelters before they were kidnapped. And the shelters, they know, never were able to help them, because if they were able to help them like they said they were going to help them, they wouldn't be kidnapped. They wouldn't be in the sole custody of their abusers, and they wouldn't now be running for their life on the street. So they've seen what happens in the shelters. Our shelters are not designed to do a thing about these custody kidnappings, and they can't help.
Well, once there's a court order in place, and this is what we both discovered, and from speaking to countless women, and the research is out there gathered over 20 years, that once these court orders are in place, there is nothing that anybody will do, not even question them. So the people that become further intimidate the children are actually people the children are told they're supposed to trust. So what happens once a judge makes a custody order, especially these extreme custody orders where they're completely cut off from the protective family members that they felt safe and secure with, then everybody else around them enforces this court order, from teachers to doctors to policemen, police women, child protective workers that they get referred to if they try to reach out to anybody for help. If they go to a shelter, they always get referred to a child protective worker, and everybody's beholden to these court orders. No matter how inhumane they are, it seems like there is a lack of conscience in society these days to say, this is wrong. I mean, what our children need, what these children need, are people saying, this is wrong, and a public outrage, and standing up against something that's so on its face inhumane. Even without proof or evidence, you know, that people say, well, I don't have proof or evidence. Even lawyers will say, well, there's no proof or evidence, or we don't have enough proof or evidence of what the children said. But the thing is, it's obviously inhumane, barbaric, and a form of torture to cut children off from family they feel safe and secure with and want to be with. And that should incite enough public outrage to say, this is wrong, and we cannot allow these custody orders that do this to continue, as opposed to criminalizing the protective parent if they encounter the child, or using them to intimidate a child who's desperate often to be or see their mothers and grandparents and everybody in the family that they've been cut off from.
Right, that's a very good point, because this child hasn't just been cut off from the protective parent that tried to get help through our courts, but they were cut off from all family and friends that has anything to do with that protective parent. And basically through the court order, once that judge signs it and erases that protective parent out of that child's life, that's basically what does it. And then, you know, family that can have access to the children, they don't. They have fears of their own. They've already seen what happens when someone does try to have contact, and they don't want to go against the court order. They don't want to cause trouble. They don't want to get the protective parent in further trouble. So they won't even try to reach out to the child. The child or children end up completely isolated from everyone and anyone that would love them and protect them, and is left in imminent danger and is forced to run. These are the children that we're talking about. Tanis, you touched on something I wanted to, we discussed this, you and I, earlier today on the phone. We talked about the guilty until proven innocent protocol. You know,
right.
How, you know, what it used to be like. You know, the government itself had to show cause, show proof and have cause, for what what they would be doing regarding our children. But nowadays, it's they just kind of come in. We have to defend ourselves. You know, before, if they're going to remove a child from a home, they had to show just cause as to why they needed to remove the child from the home. They had to have proof. They had to document it. They had to document their hours, everything. You know, it was micromanaged to the T. And if there's nowadays what it is in our family law courts is once a protective parent walks into that courtroom, to that hearing, a judge can terminate that parent's rights and not have to show any proof or cause for doing so, and instead force that parent to completely defend themselves as to why they shouldn't have removed the child from them and given it to the abuser.
That's exactly right. And I think courts used to be, the courts or Child Protective Services had to have proof of imminent danger to remove a child, whereas I'm not sure if that's the same for Child Protective Services, but
to be imminent danger in order to remove a child.
But here in family court, because it's against the other parent, they're able to say, arbitrarily, it's based on opinion and presumption and arbitrary judgments by men and women who are judges and who basically often never meet the children. So it's very, very arbitrary. And they say, I've decided, effectively they're saying, I've decided your children don't need you. And they're going to be in the sole legal and physical custody of the parent they fear in order to punish. Often the protective parent, it's a form of punishment to say for believing the child and trying to protect the child through the only system that's available to the public and protective parents. So it's not like protective parents are saying they have a lot of choices. They just don't. They don't. The system is set up that we have to call and report any suspicion of abuse, then go to family court if it's a divorce or separation, only to find that in family court they can actually kidnap and steal your children without any just cause, without any legitimate reason, but based on opinion, presumption, and very arbitrary judgments, which usually include the theory of parental alienation. If the child doesn't want to go because they're terrified, they feel unsafe, usually includes conjecture that the protective parent is mentally ill or delusional for believing the child. Often the protective parent gets charged with contempt of court because there were times, you know, usually this doesn't automatically go to sole custody for their the other parent. It usually starts with joint custody of some form. So any time the child doesn't go according to the joint custody order, the other parent's in contempt of court, the parent that doesn't force the child to go. So, I mean, and then fines are laid, and it just continues from there.
Right, exactly. And the whole guilty until you prove yourself innocent, what typically happens is from, you know, the moment that the child is ordered into the sole custody of the criminal, the criminal hiding as the parent, the other parent then has to fight hard for years and years and years to try to prove their own innocence. The protocol is set up so that the protective parent is attacked and left so vulnerable that all they're doing from nonstop from the second their children are kidnapped is defending themselves and running themselves crazy because they can't believe this is happening. Meanwhile, while they're fighting, and I got to tell you, the more court hearings that happen after the kidnapping, the worse the protected parent gets buried in court orders. I mean, the judge is harsh on the protected parent, and it's done on purpose. Because it's supposed to, turn that protective parent even into more of an emotional, psychological mess by hammering on the protective parent so that that parent will eventually go away and just be like, I give up. I mean, because there's no fighting it, there's no winning. So the more court hearings that there are following the kidnapping, as in my case, there were 14, I believe, within a year from March 2011 to March of 2012. But the more court hearings there are, the more chaos and confusion, the more hammering on the protective parent, and the more that they work to cover up all of their corruption and try to just send that protective parent running and screaming in all directions. So meanwhile, getting back to where this leaves our children having no idea about these court hearings, these multiple court hearings, having no idea that their protected parent did believe them, is fighting for them, because they're not in the court hearings. They're not in there. They're not there in every single, you know, sitting there listening to the evidence and seeing that parent fighting for their life. So these children are left in isolation, basically held captive, you said it, at the abuser's home, and not able to have a word or a say at all. They'll keep screaming to everybody and anybody that'll listen, or anybody that'll even think to ask, until they get silenced enough that they realize nobody's going to help them, and they think it's because no one listened and no one believed them, when in fact it's the opposite. Tannis, you and I talked about this earlier. In my years of work as a guardian ad litem and also doing the hands-on parenting, I was successful in every custody case that I got involved in, and it was because I believed the child first and foremost. I made a point to get to know the child. I listen to the child. I watch the child's body language. There's studies out there, this and that, that children report a believable abuse at such and such a percent. Well, I'll tell you, firsthand experience, children will report abuse when there is abuse. When there is a child that is suspected of being coached, it doesn't take a rocket scientist or even anybody with a high school education to see the difference in a coached child versus a child that's been abused and battered. A coached child is robotic in nature and shows no emotion into the words that they're using, and will repeat a phrase over and over again, almost word for word, as they were taught, especially the younger the child is. So this is one of the problems and one of the myths in our society that keeps our children on the run from these court-ordered homes, is that children are falsely reporting abuse. Children don't.
That's right. And they're not all on the run. Many are just at risk, right?
I'm only talking about the kids on the run tonight.
Right.
Yes, you're right.
And you said something very important too, and I stand in the same, from the same position, that the necessity of believing children. I mean, it's that simple. All of this could be corrected on a if the professionals started with believing the children, and society started realizing that it's hard enough for children to tell. And when they do, they, if anything, underreport. I mean, anybody that has researched this issue, and there's a plethora of research on it, the writing saying that children will underreport. One known specialist in Canada is Dr. Peter Jaffe, and he's written in conjunction with other professionals, seminal research called Tipping the Balance, and talking about kids, why they don't tell, why they delay telling, when they do tell, why they only often tell a tip of the iceberg. They might of abuse, you know, everything that isn't told. Many children don't have the language to describe everything or describe it in detail, especially when they're quite young. But when they say things that constitute abuse, those interviewing them should believe them, right? As opposed to you know, it's often spontaneous utterances with their, you know, someone in their family that they feel safe with, often their moms, that it might get reported then from there, and then they are interviewed. And unfortunately, most of the professionals do not invest the time in making the children feel safe. So children can actually even appear robotic with a professional that they meet with once and they're expected to trust and not told that they're going to be protected if they tell. I mean, that's one of the things. They're not reassured they're going to be protected if they tell. So if they've been threatened and have to live with or know that they have to go back, even if it's not in the sole custody of, but when they're little or it might be joint custody and they've been threatened, if they tell anybody, they're going to be punished or bad things are going to happen. And then they meet with somebody, a stranger, that might interview them at school or at some, not even explain to them why they're interviewing them, and then expect them to trust them and not be told, you know, I need you to tell me about what you told your grandma or your mom or, you know, somebody else that reported it, and I'm going to make sure you're going to be safe. I'm going to make sure that that won't happen again. Most professionals they won't tell the child that because they can't guarantee that. So these children are supposed to trust these professionals. And I believe, Donna, you're one of the few that put in the time to getting to know the children, but many of them don't. They meet them once and then they go, oh, not substantiated. In fact, wasn't it Karen Anderson that said 7% worth of disclosures made to child protective, child welfare authorities were substantiated? It's almost like in that saying 93% weren't telling the truth when it's the opposite.
Right,
like,
exactly.
There are researchers that say 99%, when a child does tell, 99%, 98% of the time, they're telling the truth. And if anything, they're under-reporting it.
Yep, that's exactly what's happening now. They're under-reporting it. And I think you also touched on something with the interviewing. You know, after a child discloses abuse, you know, there's different forms of interviews and assessments and forensics that have to happen to this child, you know, especially if it's a nature of child sexual abuse, you know, and they even go through such thing as a type of a rape kit process, you know, and so we're talking about uncomfortable, really putting yourself out there. We're really, when a child discloses abuse, we're just about torturing them to death. To tell us every detail and to define every detail of what their predator or their abuser did to them. And then that gets all written up into an expert's report. You know, you've got a couple expert reports now about all of this after you've tormented the poor child through everything. These expert reports are then submitted into the court. The judge ignores them, signs the court order, puts the child in the abuser's home again. So look at what this child is now facing. You know, went and told everybody, told the teacher, told, you know, their mother or their father, whoever the safe parent was at the time, safe caregiver, you know, maybe told a therapist, underwent a child sexual abuse response kit thing, you know, maybe underwent some sort of physical assessment at a ER, you know, after they reported the abuse. So now we've gone through all this uncomfortable torture on a child because they disclosed what was happening to them. It was ignored completely in the court. The child is now in the monster's home, in the abuser's home. You know.
Also the way they're not protected is that very information that they told verbatim is given right to their abuser. I mean, who's ever heard of this? In domestic abuse situations, I mean, this is domestic abuse. And there's a recognition that it's incredibly, risky and even dangerous for an adult, survivor to talk about what happened. And if that goes right into the hands of their abuser and then they're not protected there, they're made and forced to go back after they've told a therapist or the police or whatever. This is unheard of, but this is what is being done to these children. And they are so vulnerable, and they almost never get legal defense themselves, and the protective parent isn't allowed to hire legal defense on their behalf. So, and these cases never go to criminal court where they maybe would get legal defense of a district attorney or crown attorney in Canada. It's not happening. So these children are stripped of their safety, their security of person, and they're not defend it at all.
Right, you just said it, stripped of their safety and their security. You said, you know, abusers then get access to these disclosures, you know, like I was saying, if it was an expert witness report or a child specialist interviewing the child and word for word what the child said, or a tape recording of the child, the abuser gets full access to all of that. Like in my own case, I was shocked that my ex-husband got access to some of the stuff that my sons had disclosed to other professionals and experts, and even a guardian ad litem, a former guardian ad litem on our case. Our son had disclosed another abusive incident, and one of my sons even wrote in one police report he feared what his father would do to retaliate against him. And so here it is, he gets full custody of our children by kidnapping them, and he also gets access to everything our sons have said in their fear of him and what he's going to do to them for telling. Because my sons, when he kidnapped them, our sons came forward with other disclosures of abuse that I wasn't even aware of for years, that they were threatened into silence. I just couldn't even believe it, that he was given access to anything that was so dangerous, to put our sons at so much risk in his care and his custody, him knowing what they were saying and who they were screaming to about him.
And that's exactly, you're reflecting what is happening in all of these situations. Like, it is unbelievable with the knowledge that's out there about the dynamics of domestic abuse of adults, and that this is being done so deliberately and purposely with children, and nobody's stopping it. That's what is just shocking to me. And when you think about it, I mean, these children are threatened and intimidated, and then to have everything they told in order to be protected, to be able to be used against them by the very person that threatened and intimidated them.
Yep. And that further silences them, because now
Absolutely.
They're in the care and custody of the abuser. And they know, the abuser now knows everything they said and who they said it to, because that abuser is going to tell them and going to threaten them. So they're not going to say another word. They are silent. They will. It's a sick cycle of abuse, stealing a child, kidnapping a child, you know, just to avoid criminal punishment or domestic violence, child abuse, which that's what this whole pedophile ring, child trafficking ring, custody kidnapping ring is all about, is to avoid prosecution in our criminal courts for domestic violence or child abuse.
It's more than that, because it's a way to maintain control.
Exactly.
It's to avoid that, to avoid prosecution, to avoid being caught, but also a way to maintain control.
Exactly.
And it's licensed. It's legalized. And that's why nobody questions it. That's why even though people doing that are delving into the magnitude of human trafficking by you know, street people like that are, you know, posing as boyfriends, and they basically then lure the you know, teenager, often girls, but they're not recognizing the people that have a great understanding, grasp of the horror of that reality for countless youth, and even children as young as like 10 and 11, they don't have a grasp that this could actually be an aspect of that horrifying trafficking, because it's been legalized, it's sanctioned.
Right. It's been legalized, and it's a pandemic throughout our world, but yet it's a silent battle. It's an isolating battle for the protected parent and for the child, the children caught up in it. Everybody is forcefully silenced, and mostly out of fear, intimidation, threats, and that's for every victim of it, the parent and the child. And so it's this huge the public is so unaware of what is happening, because we've said it before, Tanis, if you don't have a reason to walk into the court, the custody courts, for a protection order or a custody hearing involving any criminal elements to it, you're not going to have any idea this is happening. And there's like millions of children. This has been going on for generations. You know, it used to be where people were, you know, in divorce proceedings for years at a time, spending thousands of dollars, to the point now that kidnappings can happen within days or even within hours, depending on the individual case. You know, it's such a set protocol, but yet it's such a silent battle. It's so isolating.
Well, there's another reason, and that is that the media refuses, the mainstream media refuses to cover it. So we're, you know, we're very grateful for shows like this, an opportunity to speak about this issue that Stephen Roberts is hosting and producing on four different networks right now. Stephen will give you an opportunity to talk about that a little bit, but it's the alternative media people that are opening up the airwaves, the internet airwaves, and social media through Facebook, that people are able to connect, because mainstream media will not cover this, and it's hard to know why. I mean, the few that have had the courage to put it out there, and maybe there's such a backlash. Maybe the people that are invested in making sure this is covered up threaten them, and we soldier on in it, you know, those of us that are directly affected and are very aware of this, because we can't be silenced about it. It involves too many children's lives. And one of the things that, you know, we may be talking, we're reaching out to youth and hoping that they're tapping into this and listening, but one of the reasons we're discussing what actually happens is to help you young people that have endured this or are enduring this to be able to make sense of it, because you're not getting an explanation of what is happening behind the scenes, and it's hard to know that anything is. And there are people, there are a lot of people that do believe you, and especially your protective parents, and in many of these cases, your moms and other family members. And this is something that we have to all join together to fight against. And if it's just those of us that have undergone it, and communicating with each other and connecting with each other, and battling this, what I feel is very much a spiritual battle, to make changes, and sooner than later, because these are very dire times for so many kids.
Yep, exactly. And you know, you said it, Tanis. You know, the whole mission of the Giving Children Hope show is to reach out to all of our children. You know, any child that has experienced any form of child abuse, you know, the first thing that I would say is, you know, to just remind them that child abuse is wrong, because children will disclose and only get to such a point, especially our kidnapped children through the custody kidnapping, where they just realize nobody's going to listen or hear them. They lose that, you know, they become hopeless and helpless, and they lose that spirit to keep fighting. So I want to reach out to these children. We want to give them hope and let them know we're trying to make a difference. Yeah, maybe mainstream media is slow to pick this up, which I got to tell you, the first one that does is going to have their hands full. I mean, look at the cases we just submitted to the Department of Justice alone, over 250 cases, almost 300 cases, just him here in the United States alone, from every single state. But you know what I mean? So maybe mainstream media is slow to pick this up, but I gotta hand it to the alternative internet radio, these blog shows, because these are the people that have the courage to take a stand and do something for all of our children. And this is what it's about. It's reaching out to all of them any way we know how, and we know that our children are experts with social media. So this, more than grateful that we at least have this source, and hopefully we can get more mainstream media to pick this up and start, you know, giving all of our children a voice.
Well, it's more. There's more greater likelihood that the youth will hear it through the alternative social media, and this was posted on Twitter. We're hoping, thanks to Stephen Roberts, who has the technological acumen. And is producing this show, and will also produce an MP3 archived show for anybody that isn't able to listen in, but we can get it out or post it on Giving Children Hope site, but and also we can be contacted that way. So we would like any youth to reach out to us, anybody that wants to contact Donna or I about anything that's said here, to private message either of us at Giving Children Hope. But the youth also can be part of the change in, you know, if you're a friend, if you are safe now, but have endured this and could reach out to someone that might not be, and let them know that many professionals will say if an older youth, like a teenager, were to tell them directly, like some years later after being away from the parent that got accused for believing them of parental alienation or false allegations or whatever, if they come forward themselves, that, you know, even go to a police station themselves and say, look, this is happening to me, and they can't accuse the protective parent of influencing them, because many of these children and youth have been cut off from their protective parent and family members for years. So if there is something going on, you do have the right and to confidentially go to any police station and make a report of what is happening. And I think children even need to know this, like children 10, 11 years old, often they, you know, they walk past a police station and we're in their neighborhood or whatever. And if there's things going on that are wrong, any kind of abuse, you're being hit, kicked, slapped, threatened with physical abuse, sexual abuse of any kind, being touched wrongly and being hurt in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable, you need to report that, as scary as it is and as much as you've been told you better not. Police and other professionals have promised they'll believe you. So you can hold them to that promise. And also, I think youth can assert their rights and say, look, I'm not going back there. Even if there is a custody order, I am not, and I'm told that it's in place till I'm 18. If you're being abused, you can assert your right to be safe, because that does supersede everything, and say, I refuse to be forced to go back to where I don't feel safe and I'm not safe.
Right, that's exactly it.
You ready to take a break now?
Yep, let's do it. You ready, Tannis?
Yes, I just want to, do we want to open the phone lines or respond to anybody that wants to call in after the break, or?
What do you want to do, Stephen? Or do you want to regroup during the break?
Yeah, let's do that then.
Regroup, what do you mean?
Discuss it.
Sure, I guess we can. All right. I'll put a song on here and take a little break.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right. All right, we're back from the break, everyone. Donna and Tannis are going to talk for a minute while I bring somebody up. I guess Tannis set something up with Andrew and her son, Kevin Kluman. Kevin's a 17-year-old. He's been on two other times. We're going to bring him up on again and have a nice little chat. So go ahead and talk for a minute, ladies, and I'll bring Kevin up.
Did you have anything more that you wanted to say from before the break, Donna?
Yeah, actually, before you bring Kevin on, I wanted to add on to what you were saying about the police and encouraging children to go to the police, which, yes, I mean, myself, I want to encourage children to call 911 and when there's any abuse going on. But unfortunately, in my own son's situation, you know, they did go to police, and they also knew that if they ran, police were going to bring them back to their father's home. And it's just a fact. They just know that's going to happen. So I was going to encourage children tonight, and I know that this will be okay, but any child that's out there that's on our streets, that's alone, that it has escaped a violent home, an abusive home, in this type of situation, I want to ask that they reach out to Charles Stecker Jr. He's planning to do a Turn Up the Volume tour, and he's planning to go through all the states and some provinces through Canada. I forget the number of them, if it was 14 different provinces. But I want to encourage the children to reach out to him. He is the founder and executive director of the International Child Abuse Prevention Task Force. His mission with the Turn Up the Volume tour is to reach out to all of our children who are getting battered and abused. He's going to be touring in individual states. These children could actually meet him at the state capitals. You know, even our children that are on the streets that have run can meet him at the state capitals and get very involved in what's going on and what made them run. He could be a huge resource for these children. He's someone that the children can find on Facebook. You know, so he's even on my friends list on Facebook. If any child wants to find me, Donna Farris, F-A-R-R-I-S, Charles Stecker Jr. I think Stephen, do we have his phone number? Because I'm pretty sure Charles wouldn't mind me putting that on here.
Charles's phone number. I might be able to find it, but I'm not positive. But I couldn't get through to Ann. There's some kind of a problem. I sent you a message in the... Okay, yeah. I can look and see if I got Charles's number, yes.
Yeah, because if Charles is even listening tonight, and we can get him on the phone to talk a little bit more, his Turn Up the Volume tour is getting ready to go in a couple months. And if we could kind of get this out there and get this advertised and at least have a good connection for our children who really need him, our children on the
street. I do have his mobile number.
Yeah, and can we put his name in the chat room even?
Sure, I guess, but try to give him a call too if you'd like.
Yeah, let's see if we can get him on the phone. Thank you.
Before we do that, this is what we are trying to work out, letting young people know that we're also striving for solutions, but we are aware of the barriers to that many of you have told. If you are listening and have a reason to feel betrayed by the very authorities that are mandated to protect you. So, however, in researching this, the authorities do say, including, a young person, even of 12 years of age, there are things that a young person can demand to have a lawyer, have legal counsel, and there are usually phone numbers for that in every major center. Usually I'm not sure if it's called legal aid in the United States. Is it legal aid?
I think so, yeah. But there's no luck on Charles either yet.
Young people should be able to call. I would think that it's probably best, if you're at school, to call from a payphone. I think most schools still have a payphone. If you have your own phone, because usually those are monitored by someone who has complete control in cases like this, so it's better to use a friend's phone or to use a pay phone and start getting resources, finding out, saying, I want a lawyer, even to ask for a lawyer to start to see your family that you miss and want to be with. even to assert your rights. Part of this is that the courts are not listening to children and youth, not listening to their wishes, not listening to their feelings. And this could start to change if children and young people, youth, start demanding their rights to family they love and miss. And as scary as that is, the more you keep shouting out as young people, even though you've been threatened and intimidated, often that is just to keep you silent. Abusers are known to use threats and intimidate in order to not be caught. But in situations like this, a lot of people are watching, and there are teachers around, there are police, there are lawyers out there, and if you start to feel empowered by messages that, you know, there are people that believed you, that you could start checking out those resources and saying, look, I need to tell you this in confidence, and then that may mean making a police report, going into a police station, meaning just telling the police what's happening. It may mean making a phone call to legal aid and saying, look, I need a lawyer to help get back to see family that I haven't been allowed to see, and or to help protect me. Same with a guidance counselor, look, to share your concerns, but you don't want them to call child welfare and have it reported back. The problem is so often these authorities are reporting back and not realizing how much greater danger they're putting children and youth in. So I think it's important for our youth to be able to say, but I'm telling you this in confidence. I'm trusting that you will not put me in greater risk by going back and reporting what I've said, because I've been threatened if I tell you.
Right. Well, here's basically, you know, what I've seen, what I've experienced is that children do, you know, tell, and they do keep telling. Children know abuse is wrong. I mean, you know, we teach them that everywhere they go, at home, in school, in the community, any type of abuse, report it. And there are professionals that the child will report to that do try to help that child. You know, it's usually a custody proceeding because that's what it's hidden under. The kidnapping and the trafficking is hidden under the title of a custody proceeding, a custody hearing. Some of the professionals that are in on it are in on the conspiracy to kidnap, and others do their very best to even testify. We even come to the court or call in and testify as an expert to try to help that child. The unfortunate reality is all of our entities that are in place to help our children who disclose abuse are failing them in every single direction. At this point, it's going to take all of us screaming with all of our children, and I'm saying with all of our children, because our children continue screaming. God bless my son's hearts. They continued screaming even months after the kidnapping, and to anybody that would listen, until they got to the point of, I don't even know what to call it, they hopelessness. No one's going to listen. No one's going to do anything. So the unfortunate reality, Tannis, is that the children get to the point of being so terrified, they're not going to feel like anyone's going to believe them. They're not going to feel like they could trust anyone because, again, they're not in these court custody proceedings. I use that term lightly, custody proceedings. So they don't know, and they're left wondering, you know, what to do. You know, we need to scream with them. We can't leave them left hanging to the point of getting so desperate they have to run away on our streets and hide from everybody and anybody. We need to step up and scream with our children together. This is an isolating battle, every person that's in it, every protected parent that's out there listening tonight, you know what I'm saying. It's isolating. It's a forcefully silenced battle. The fear alone that you feel just for your child's safety keeps you quiet in most cases, let alone the fear you feel of being chased after by your ex-abuser who now has full control over you because he or she has full custody of your child. It's going to take
That's absolutely right. Like, and the children are told if they seek out their protective parent, and often their mothers in these cases, they'll get their mothers in trouble or they'll never see them again, and so they're left with that fear. Maybe what needs to happen is a network of safe houses where other people that are willing to stand up against this that is so obviously wrong, since the legislators won't stop it, all the authorities are enforcing these court orders rather than saying these are wrong. This is a form of child torture. This inhumanity is a crime against humanity. These are international violations of human rights. These are unconstitutional, these orders, just segregating children from family they love. And until all of society says this is wrong, you don't do this to children, keep them from family they love, then these kids have to find some alternative. I just was saying this about the police because I've been told by authorities, you know, in asking questions about this, are children really complete property of the state until they're 18? Like, do these children have absolutely no rights if they assert them themselves? And they do. It's just nobody teaches them that. If they take a stand and say, I am not going back there, custody order or not, just like a marriage license or not, I'm not going back there. I am not going to be forced to go and live where I don't feel safe. There's really nobody that can drag them back. And yet they're being intimidated to think they have to obey this until they're 18 because that's the way it's presented to them. But they can start researching that they have rights and demanding and asserting those rights. So I agree with you, Donna, but this is where we need to support by educating young people. And I've heard that, you know, if they do run to where they feel safe, it may not be their mother because of this, because the court order is mostly asserted on their mother. But let's say an aunt or uncle, grandparent, family member, or friend of family they feel safe with, right? And they get there and they say, you're not turning me in, and I want a lawyer and I want my rights defended to be safe. And if they make the report themselves after how many years of being separated from the protective parent that was accused of alienating them from the abuser, they have to be listened to. And this is where young people, when they're educated, can enforce their rights. It's far better than giving up complete hope and them, you know, fighting. And I agree, we have to stand up with them and for them, all the people that understand that this is a problem, which means actually having some backbone and courage and not being so deferential to a court order saying, oh, you know, like I could, you know, well, maybe it will take going to prison to do what's right, just like during the civil rights movement.
Right, exactly. Well, you said it, you know, it's going to take the families and the friends, because when there's a custody kidnapping, the people that know that protective parent, that loving parent, and know that child their whole lives almost, I mean, just about, their family, their friends, they all back off for whatever reason is whatever reason they have. Again, I said this is an isolating battle. You're in it alone. You're stuck alone. Your child's stuck alone. Your family and friends are, for whatever reason, back off. And what it's going to take in order to truly protect our children is our families and our friends who are aware of this to step up, put everything else aside in their lives, step up and do whatever they can to fight for that child. If one of my sons, either Matthew or Donovan, were out on the street somewhere right now, I would be screaming my head off for everyone in my family and my friends to be stepping up, to be their voice and help me find them and get them to safety. And that's what it's going to take, is every one of us, family, friends, community, neighborhoods, you name it. It's going to take all of us standing together to save even one child from this.
And unfortunately, we're not in that place. People, there's a real echo now.
Yeah, that's why I stopped is echoing. But yeah, go ahead.
But we're trying to motivate people to...
Hey, Donna, Candace.
Yes?
I got Kevin on the line.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, Kevin. I just want to thank you for being brave and coming on. I have listened to you on a show with Stephen before, and I would like to invite you to share, you know, I don't know if you listened to the first hour and a bit here tonight, but if you have, and if you have any thoughts on reaching out to people, young people your age, because you're 17, right, Kevin?
Yeah.
And if you have anything that you could share with young people about what we're saying here as two adults.
I tell adults, like, tell them what?
Well, first I want to say hi, Kevin. This is Donna Ferris. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you for coming on the show and being willing to talk. You're 17, which is actually the age of my oldest son. He turns 18 in just over 2 months now. I don't know about your situation. Do you mind kind of just filling me in a little bit about what you've been experiencing?
Yeah, sure. So... I guess I'll back up to when I was little. Like, I lived with my mom and my dad, and my dad was always really violent. Like, he'd yell, like, at my mom and then, like, push her and, like, beat her up and stuff, and then I would just, like, hear it most of the time. I sometimes see it. And then, like, just as I grew up, like, one time he choked me because I didn't take a shower, like, fast enough. And then, like, when I was 15... Well, eventually they got divorced because of, like, domestic violence and, yeah. And then when I was 15, I had a heart attack and heart surgery. And, after that, I started having some serious complications that my doctors, have, like, little experience with because I had an extremely rare condition. And so the doctors accused my mom of Munchausen syndrome, which is basically making up, like, symptoms, and they said that she made me had a heart attack. And so then I had to go into CPS, and basically my dad piggybacked off of that, and he was, like, taking custody. And it was a rough time for me because I mean, I was scared and so yeah, that's just kind of where I'm at now. Just my dad just trying to take custody, and, like, I guess that's it.
So, Kevin, I know who you are. This is Donna again. I saw a video that you had made, a YouTube video, and you were talking about this, and you just sounded so, like, frustrated, like, will somebody listen to me, you know? I'm like, how loud do you need to scream, you know, to get people to listen? You know, you've been through a horrifying experience. Horrifying. I'm so sorry to even hear any of this. No child deserves it.
Yeah, it's really hard to, like, talk about it, like, physically. Like, I get, like, tics when I kind of just... But I know I want to share with people, like, tell people about, like what's going on, and just kind of share my experience, because I know it can help others.
It can. That's the thing. Like, even when I saw your video, it helped me because I fed off of your strength the day I saw it. Like, I was like, that's it. I'm going to help every child there is, you know, after I saw your video, because it really touched my heart. Right now, you said that your father was trying to take custody. Where is that at right now?
Right now, I think there's a review going on. Like, if the case should be dismissed or not, I'm not sure. Right now, I live with my mom. My dad lives in a different city.
Well, I'm very happy to hear you're with your mother. She must just feel like such a huge blessing to have you back in her arms. And right now, you're waiting for it to be dismissed?
Yeah.
Now, where's your father for all of the violence?
Where is he?
You said he's in another city?
Yeah, he's in the same state. He's just in a different city.
Oh. Now, this show tonight, Kevin, we've been really focusing on the children, you know, teenagers like yourself that are ordered into abusive homes, and such as your father, very abusive, very dangerous men. My son was choked by his father as well. And so I know what you're saying and just the terror with that. And thank you. I bless your heart for even sharing that with us tonight. But the children we're focusing on are the ones who run away. You know, the ones who are out on the streets. They don't know a soul. They don't have a penny in their pocket. But to them, it's safer being out there than in that home, that type of home. If there's anything, you know, you could say any of these children are listening tonight, you know, for any chance, and, you know, to just give them hope. Anything that you could, you know, give them some advice.
Well, if any of them are listening, I think I would say, just do whatever you want to do, just however you feel safest, because I know if I had to live with my dad, I'd run away too. I mean, because I would feel happier knowing that I'd be safe.
Right.
I mean, being out alone, like, in the world isn't exactly the safest thing, but if it makes you feel better, I think that's the right thing to do. And you should just follow your gut instinct. As for hope, I mean, there's always hope. Like, if you're choosing to just kind of be out there on your own a little early, I mean, it doesn't mean your life is over just because you don't have a house. I mean, you can always just, like, go to school. And I mean, just because you're homeless doesn't mean there is no hope left.
Exactly. And we want all...
Which is why I'm not afraid of being, like, out on the streets. If it came to that, if I had to live with my dad and I chose not to. Because I know it's not the end of the world for me.
Right. And that's kind of what I was saying at the beginning of this show, is how brave and courageous those children are to even, you know, take the courage that it takes to run, and then to be out alone on the streets with, you know, the number of predators we've got in society nowadays, the level of violence. But you're right, there's hope in all of this. You know, look at your situation now. You know, I don't... How long were you going through that? How old were you when that started?
What exactly started?
When CPS first wanted to remove you from your mother.
I was 16.
You were 16?
So, yeah, last November 2012.
And I know that there's some 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds out on the streets tonight. You know, and they're probably listening. I hope they're listening, and I hope they hear, you know, that there is hope, and there's kids like you that, you know, keep fighting for them, and you're screaming for them now, too. So thank you.
Can you say, Kevin, how you did get back to your mom's?
How I got back?
Yeah. Did CPS allow that, or did you fight for that? And did you get a lawyer and ask for a lawyer to be able to go back to your mom's? How did that work out?
Actually, the way that happened was, to me, I thought it was like pretty dumb. Basically, they took me and they had me live with my dad's mom. And then they said, if you live with your dad for 2 weeks, we'll let you go back with your mom. And that was literally it. They didn't do any, like, counseling. They didn't do any investigation. Or just because when I was in CPS's custody, I almost died. And so I think they just got scared and gave me back to my mom. Mm. I was only, like, out of my mom's care for 30 days. And then the whole case got dismissed, I think 3 months after.
Wow. You also have a younger sibling that it's up in the air about whether this custody will go back to your dad. I mean, you're almost 18, so really you should have complete say, and the general public thinks that a youth your age would have complete say of which parent they wanted to live with, but apparently not.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, the courts say they're not going to listen to anything I say. But if it comes down to that the custody switches, I think running away will be the biggest voice if I have to do that.
Right.
What about your younger sibling?
Right.
That's something I haven't thought of that much.
Well, Kevin, I want to ask you, did you report child abuse? What I'm getting at is, what has been your experience when you report any type of abuse, any type of witnessing domestic violence, any type of abuse by your father? I mean, because I'm sure you told CPS, you know, what has been going on and stuff. What was your experience when you reported any type of abuse?
I talked about it with counselors.
Like, oh, okay.
When I was in fourth grade, just like a counselor. I can't remember, but I guess I just told her. And with CPS, I didn't really talk about my dad because they were accusing my mom of child abuse.
Right, so I
fought against it because I knew it wasn't true.
Right.
How did you know, Kevin, they were accusing your mom?
I remember just like one night, basically the ambulance came to our house and they forced us to go to the ER. And they said, my mom has to leave now, and they called Child Protective Services. And I didn't know why. But then, like 3 days later, they gave me a list of allegations against my mom.
Who made those allegations?
They were... doctors. Yeah, like my cardiologist and my normal doctor. They were mostly saying that, like, my mom brings me back to the doctor and makes me have, like, unnecessary tests, and it's harmful, apparently, and that I've never had a heart attack, and that she made me have heart surgery. To me, I think my doctors just couldn't deal with my condition. My condition is chronic pericarditis, and I'm having a flare-up right now, so it's kind of It's a little painful.
Right.
So yeah, my doc. I think my doctors just couldn't handle my condition and didn't want to deal with me, so they called CPS. And when they gave me, like, put me in custody, they told my dad's parents, the people who were taking care of me, not to bring me to the doctor or ER unless I'm blue or, like, passed out. And so I had to spend 3 days. I was just in incredible pain, and I could barely breathe, and I couldn't walk more than 10 feet without collapsing. And then finally, I had a doctor's appointment. Then I had pneumonia, 104 fever, and fluid around my lungs and heart. And then from that point, CPS basically started giving me back to my mom, first with, like, visitation, and then full custody.
It's unreal that you had to go through that. I mean, the stress of being separated from your mom, who you felt safe and secure with, who was very sensitive and tuned in to what was going on to you, your medical, your needs, your health, as many of the protective parents are to their children, and yet to have that stress. Even though you were a little older, what you were going through was so serious, to have that stress of being cut off from your where you felt at home and comfortable and understood and supported. It's just it's horrible.
Yeah, at the time it was really emotionally really emotionally hard, very hard on me. I was crying a lot, and like looking back at it now, I have no idea how younger kids cope with like such a traumatic experience. But then at the same time, I had to deal with my pericarditis, which was also very physically painful.
And right, so you had that.
I just hope no one has to go through that.
Right.
Something unnecessarily.
Well, right. It's emotional abuse. And the irony of this is many, many protective parents are being accused of that for believing their children, or in your mom's case, believing that you had these physical problems that were real. And she just was very sensitive to your health needs. And instead of that being respected, it was used against her. And you got emotionally abused in this. That's to have separated you from your nurturing support where you felt comfortable is emotional abuse. And that's what is also being done to children in these custody orders. Like you said, much younger, for prolonged periods of time, it's emotional abuse.
Right. I mean, Kevin, I couldn't imagine what you would be going through at that time, having such a serious medical condition, at the point of needing a loving, protective parent with you, being completely kidnapped from that parent, just the emotional trauma alone of having to be forced out of your home and away from your mother in this situation, sick as could be. It's just, like you said it, I can't imagine what our children go through, because this is what happens in the court-ordered custody kidnappings as well, is these children, they lack that understanding of what is happening to them, and they're at a time when they need that loving, protective parent the most. They just disclose serious child abuse or violence, and now they're being sent into their abuser's home. Is when they are ripped away from the one person they need the most. And how traumatic is that? That, to me, these kidnappings are the most serious form of child abuse there is. I mean, tonight we're talking about how serious and severe it gets to the point of our children running away to the safety of our streets. Come on, I can't even believe I said that. safety of our streets versus a safety of a good, loving home. This is what the show is about. We've got to be their voice and take a stand together, all of us, for all of these children and end this child abuse. I want to say thank you, Kevin, for coming on the show tonight and sharing all of this with us. Do you have anything else you want to share for any kids that might be listening?
Well, to anyone who's going through like a hard time, what I did when I was in CPS and had to live with my dad, I played a lot of video games because it got my mind off of things. And that's something you have to make sure you do something you like doing, like during like stressful times. If you're with your parent you don't want to be with, I mean, try to make, what was I going to say? Oh, just make sure you're doing something fun for yourself and not being overwhelmed with the stress, and just
try to make best of the situation.
Yeah,
that's great advice, Kevin. And I want to say again, you are so brave for everything you've gone through. I want to thank you from my heart for coming on the show tonight and giving all of our children a voice. You're very strong for just coming out and taking a stand against this, because it's so wrong. So thank you. And thank you for reaching out to all of our children with us tonight.
And you are a very mature young man. And I applaud you for putting YouTubes out. I think that's also a way for young people to get their voices out on this situation and speak about these things. That's a very technology that's been used against a lot of children that can actually be used to help a lot of young people. So your voice matters, and your testimony, your experience, your speaking out against this really does make a difference, Kevin.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And I just happened...
I'm really glad it is.
Yes, Kevin, just before you go, I just happened to look in one of the chat rooms real quick, and just from one person saying, yes, Kevin, thank you. My son is not ready to talk about his ordeal, so thank you for being so strong. Another one says, yes, you're very brave. You know, thank God you're old enough and you had contact and you know the truth and you make a great advocate for children. Oh, it's moving quickly, so I'm trying to keep up. But
what's
you know,
your YouTube channel, Kevin?
You, the Sovereign. I just want you to know you're a hero for other children, just for being very brave. So thank you.
What's your YouTube channel, Kevin?
I think it's my name, Kevin Coleman. My last name's spelled K-U-L-M-A-N. I made a YouTube video that basically describes my situation, but I was really like loud in my video, and I was kind of like being over dramatic, but I did that to try and capture people and have people kind of feel what I'm feeling.
You did.
And how do people find that, Kevin? Can you get it to Stephen, and he could maybe post it, so
what's
anybody
that
does want to see what you're saying, and young people that may you know, be empowered by what you're doing to do the same, get out what's happening to them and crying out for help, that does affect people.
Yes.
And especially adults, we see that and go, wow. I mean,
Kevin, I was in tears. I
oh
was
my
in
gosh.
Tears watching your video, and I wanted to hug you and just tell you it's going to be okay. And I shared your video the second I finished watching it, of course, wiping my tears away. Like, we can get this kid some help. You know, come on. You set the standard, Kevin, for children. This is what, you know, this is one thing they can do. Make a YouTube video, put it out there, and try and get people's attention. You know, you're screaming for help in there. And thank
right.
you. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
You are being a voice. You are standing tall. You are very brave.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll get the video to Stephen so he can get the link.
I've actually got it up and put it in the chats already.
Okay. Awesome. And if you don't mind, I'm going to grab that video again and get it posted on. We have a Giving Children Hope Facebook page that the show is directly linked with, and I'm going to post your video on there as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah, that's fine.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Kevin. Thank you.
I kind of wanted to kind of get to a point of wrapping some things up. There's still so much we have to cover, you know, regarding our children that are out there on the run, you know, for their lives, how we can find them. I do think Charles Stecker Jr. is a good contact because he will be going state to state. You know, the children will be able to follow his route because he's going to be GPSing his steps. So any child that's out on the run on the streets, he's a good contact for them. They can meet him right on the, you know, Capitol steps when he's in their state even. So, Tannis, I just wanted to kind of wrap things up a little bit for tonight. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, just keep on going and wrap it. I might interject here and there, so continue, Dawn. It's okay.
Okay, well, I guess what I want to say, I want to reach out to all of our children, and I want to do this in every single show, because, you know, like I would for my own sons, Matthew and Donovan, you know, to tell them that there is hope. There are people screaming for them. You know, this is a battle. We are in a fight for our lives. It's not just mothers. It's fathers as well, and we've got to fight for our children. Our children are much stronger than we are, much braver than we will ever be, and less likely to let fear stop them or intimidate them. They set the standard and they're role models for all of us adults, and that's why I'm going to keep saying and keep asking all of us to take a stand with our children to end this custody kidnapping and the child trafficking and the severest form of child abuse on this planet, and do it for all of them. All of our kids that are out here listening know that we are screaming for you. We are fighting. We're not stopping. And we're going to keep trying to raise awareness around the world, in our public, in our communities, in our neighborhoods, until all of this child abuse ends and we learn in the future what not to ever do again.
And I would really like that there be safe houses in every neighborhood, that people come forward and, you know, like the block parent idea, that they start to, that even if they write to us and talk about that in terms of that their house could be a safe house, because where the child is, if they're afraid of being turned in or the youth being turned in, that they would help them take the steps to make sure that they wouldn't be turned in, like making the reports on their behalf and saying that unless this child's assured that they won't be turned back to forced to live with their abuser, that they're not going to make a report, but they'll be helped, you know, by an adult who's put themselves out there as a safe individual to go to. Like, I mean, ideally, these safe houses would be funded by the government. But if they immediately report back to the very person the youth is running from, that's the problem. So I'm sort of thinking out loud here that we need to have some grassroots stuff. And, you know, maybe the individuals that have this has touched their lives in some way, that say this is wrong and we're going to work at changing the laws and legislation that way, by standing up and saying, you know, I'm going to stand up for this one child that I know of or whatever. Just a thought.
Right. I think along that lines, it's really, in my mind, it's going to take all of us standing up and putting our lives down for a child. Say we're going to put our bodies physically in front and block anybody from trying to harm a child. I think it's what it's going to take at this point. There's just so much danger and child abuse happening that the public really needs to take a stand. And the thing is family and friends know. all of my family and friends are very much aware that my children were kidnapped in order to, for him to avoid attempted murder on a child. It's going to take everybody, everyone's family and friends to be willing to take that stand and to physically put their body in front of a child to protect the child in that family. And this is what it's going to take. Grassroots, yes, we've got to raise public awareness, but as we're doing so, we got to find everyone out there that's willing to take a stand for a child and give a voice to our children. I kind of want.
But we also need to remember these people that are in positions of public trust, the authorities, the police, the teachers, judges, politicians, they are public servants. They are paid by the taxpayer. Their wages are paid by taxpayers. And people can make a stand by phoning. If they know of a child that this has happened to, they can call all the local politicians. They can make their voice heard by writing and calling and saying, I'm not going to agree with this, or the police collectively need to start looking at these type of extreme court orders and going, there's something wrong here. We're supposed to protect the public. We're supposed to protect children, not just enforce court orders. That's their constitutional, like sheriffs and the police in Canada. They have an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, and the public can demand that. I mean, demand that they uphold what they've said they're going to do, not make these children think, you know, they're not safe to go to.
Right, that's exactly it. People can demand it. Like in my case, the DA in Kennebec County, Megan Maloney, is very much aware of the kidnapping, the corruption. She has a mountain of evidence right at her fingertips on her desk, and she still has yet to do anything. You know, it's gonna take everyone, the community, the public, family, friends, everybody, everywhere, flooding these people and making them do their job and follow the law. Let's get these criminals rounded up and let's save all of our children. It's gonna take all of us doing it. I know we just have a few minutes left to the show, and so Tanis, do you have anything that you want to say? Because I wanted to get to the final piece.
I would just encourage anybody that wants to message Donna or I to message us at Giving Children Hope, at the Facebook page Giving Children Hope, and you can indicate if you want to either of us to respond, but that's probably the easiest way to contact us, and we'll be posting, or Stephen will be posting, the archived show of this, so you can share it with anybody you would like. A good way to use this information is to embed it in a email and send it out to anybody you think that this could be useful for, or help toward this cause of helping children get their families back that they miss and need, or rescue children from situations of risk. And that's, I guess, all I would like to say for now.
Okay. Before I get to this this reading, I wanted to say thank you, Stephen, and thank you to the networks that have picked the Giving Children Hope show up. This does mean a lot to us, to Tanis and I, if you don't mind me speaking for you, Tanis.
It's People's
it's
Internet Radio.
Opportunity to give our children a voice. So thank you to all of you and all the listeners.
That's People's Internet Radio, and Scotland is free. And we have a brand new, nice, shiny donate button. Everyone go check it out. If they can, please hit it.
Yeah,
send some money.
I wanted to ask about that. What is the donate button about? Because you mentioned it last week, but I didn't even know we were doing it. What is that?
Oh, that's just keeping the stream going. That's all that basically is. And whatever extra money comes in is going to be split between all the hosts.
Oh, awesome.
Not expecting much, but who knows?
Awesome. Okay, great. So thank you, and thank you to everyone that's been listening, too. Now, before we start a show and when we go to end a Giving Children Hope show, We had agreed that we would read a scripture, a quick scripture. And the thing behind the scripture, what Tanis and I do is we don't just go in and research and pick one. We go, we just open our individual Bibles, and whatever just kind of reads, you know, leads us in that direction is what we go to. And tonight, the scripture that I'm going to read is from Revelation 22, and it's 10 through 16. And this was the first verses that jumped out at me when I opened up my Bible for tonight's show. And he saith unto me, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And he which is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still. And behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me, to give every man according as his work shall be. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they that may have right to the tree of life, and may enter through the gates into the city. For without are dogs, and sorcerers, and whoremongers, and murderers, and idolaters, and whosoever loveth and maketh a lie. I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David, and the bright and the morning star. Thought it was perfect for tonight to end the show with. I'm hoping we've reached out to our children out on the streets. I'm hoping that together we were able to give them all a voice and let them know that we're not going to stop. We're going to keep fighting for them and keep screaming for their lives and let them know we're here for them.
All right.
And if a youth contacts us at Giving Children Hope, we'll try to find whatever supports or resources in the area. Can we say that, Donna? That we will. I mean, there's quite a few people that have come forward in terms of knowing about this situation, and that we'll do whatever we can to try to connect them to people that care.
Absolutely. I'm using my personal Facebook page, which is Donna Farris, F-A-R-R-I-S. I have my profile picture is the police evidence of me hugging my son. We also have the Giving Children Hope Facebook page, and that is the page that directly follows the Giving Children Hope radio show. So that you can follow to continue to have information on weekly shows and what topics we'll be discussing and different contacts and things like that. So good question, Tanis.
And I also want to give just a final message, because I think we have a couple more minutes, that often even an older person that has been victimized can feel dirty and can feel like the things that even were spoken about in the scripture, can feel that they've been degraded and humiliated by things that have been done to them. And I just want any young person that's a victim to know that you are precious and you are loved and you were created by our Creator God, and that no matter what's been done to you, that that is always in you, that your perfection, your wholeness, and that there is hope, that all of that can be shed away, and that healing does happen, and you are loved by many people and by God, your Creator. I just want to, and no matter what you're going through or what you have gone through.
Yes, you said it perfectly. They are so loved.
Okay.
You just need to know. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you, Tanis. And thank you to everybody listening.
Yes, everyone's welcome. I want to go ahead and end this call here, Donna, and I will do something and then call you back in a couple minutes. Is that going to be all right?
Yep, that sounds great. So we're saying goodnight. Right? Until you call back?
Yes, we are. Yes.
All right.
Good night. Good night, everyone.
All right. Good night, everyone.